Blog Talk Radio.
The Occulta Philosophia, a discussion of natural magic. Sir, great men decline, mighty men fail, but an honest philosopher keeps his station forever. What I know, what you are able to protect, not with the sword, but with reason, words. These were words spoken to a mage, and now the words of a mage or magus. Seeing there is a threefold world, elementary, celestial, and intellectual, and every inferior is governed by a superior, and receive it the influences of the virtues thereof, so that the original and chief worker of all doth by angels, the heavens, stars, elements, animals, plants, metals, stones, convey from himself the virtues of his omnipotency upon us, for whose service he made and created all these things. Wise men conceive it in no way irrational that it should be possible for us to ascend by the same degrees through each world to the same very original world itself, the maker of all things. Magic is a faculty of wonderful virtue, full of the most high mystery, containing the most profound contemplation of most secret things, together with nature, power, quality, substance, and virtues thereof, as also the knowledge of whole nature. And it doth instruct us concerning the differing and agreement of things amongst themselves, whence it produceth its wonderful effects by uniting the virtues of things. The number of and the nature of those things, called element, what earth, fire, air forth brings, from whence the heavens their beginnings had, whence the tide, whence rainbow in gay colors clad, what makes the clouds that gathered are in black, to send forth lightning and a thunder crack, what doth the nightly flames and comets make, what makes the earth to swell, then quake? What is the seed of metals and of gold? What virtues, wealth, doth nature's coffer hold? Magic combines the threefold mysteries, natural forces, natural virtues, numbers, and mathematics. Proper rhythms, proper rhythmic alignments. Then there is the divine, the realms of the Most High, higher self, angels. In her compassion, God has granted us many examples of our eternal existence. One could be found simply by observing the first of the threefold mysteries. Simply observe over time a rock. A rock once lived in liquid form, then solid form. It can be liquefied again and then solidify again, depending on what elemental interactions or relationships are occurring. An example could be a rock slowly being worn down by water. Its captured particles would eventually settle and re-solidify. Or how about volcanic rock liquefying and cooling to become reborn as solid rock again? Nature, as it happens, understanding this and knowing how to interpret natural signals, can be our first step to becoming successful users of magic. During the time of the Spanish Inquisition, it was dangerous to speak of natural magic. However, this did not stop everyone from doing it. Much of what I just read, pieces of it anyway, portions of it, in this introduction, were from the writings of Cornelius Agrippa. Agrippa was a doctor, theologian, a philosopher. He was a magician, an alchemist. He, like those before him, though he had his differences with some of these philosophers, of course, but like Aristotle and Pythagoras and others, believed that magic and science are the same, that magic is in nature and that it can be harnessed for positive or negative outcomes, as well as for spiritual ascension. This is a first in a series of shows we'll be doing on Main Street Universe concerning great mystics of our past. Today we look into the life and works and reputation of Heinrich Cornelius Agrippa von Nettesheim. So join us today on Main Street Universe as we look into the life and work of this interesting human being. welcome to Main Street Universe. The show reminding you that the mysteries and possibilities of the universe are closer to Main Street than you may have ever imagined. Don't know about you, but I can imagine a lot. I will not be joined by Janice today as she is away at a gathering. And, however, I may be joined by Brett Hillman later and perhaps even Evan Poss if he ever makes it, just because he has an interest in the ancient mystics and such. We will see what happens. Maybe even a Nick Berry sighting, which occasionally has been happening recently towards the second half of shows. And remember that you can always listen to us in the archive section. I have a feeling this is going to be one of those episodes that maybe gets a lot of archive listens. Some shows generate a lot of live listens, usually ones involving readings. And some shows people listen to on their own time, usually ones that are topical, especially one without a guest. And that's fine, because remember that if you go to our Facebook page, we always post the archives as well as on our website, which we're going to work on making that a little easier, by the way. I'm going to start more often on Facebook just posting our main archive page, because sometimes I think people get a little confused when they go to click on my name and things like that. So we'll start to clear some of these things up a little bit. And then you can listen to last week, next week, this week in our archive section, of course. So today we'll be discussing our first, by the way, installment of our Great Mystics from the Past. And of course, with some of these people, it's so hard to cover everything. So this will be, you know, a brief overview of the life, works, reputation of Heinrich Cornelius Agrippa von Nettesheim, who has an interesting reputation even outside of mystical, occult, or metaphysical practice, as is often the case with some of these old occultists from the past. In the future, we'll as well generate or attempt to engage in mystics that aren't necessarily of an occult nature, but are just revolutionary within their own religious traditions, whether that just be Catholic or Muslim. Of course, in those days, such as the person we're talking about today, a lot of the times their education was through an abbey or a church or a church-sponsored university. So they were often within the Christian religion. But however, for a while anyway, the mystics we discuss will be occultists and people of that sort of history, alchemists, magicians. But then we'll sort of take it a little bit outside of that, just into revolutionaries within their own organized religion, and then kind of pull the reins back in and do some more occultists. This will slowly evolve. I'll do one of these once every, say, once every 2 months, once every month, whenever it just feels natural, like, okay, I'm ready to cover another one of these and make this part of our ongoing. I would probably say once every 2 months would feel natural if you combine the fact that we do ritual shows and everything else, occasional divination shows and other topical shows, such as things involving nature, like the bees and the bats ones we've done, or things involving issues like a community or art or music or an author, which, by the way, I did want to give a plug. Our vegan pizza gentleman that we interviewed, Mr. Mark Sutton, has had a few other sort of big-time radio interviews on regular old media radio, I might post them at some point on Facebook. I have to go grab the archive and find it. And he was kind enough as well to post our interview with him onto his main website, which is nice because then that pulls us in with some of these other, you know, bigger media names. And the one guy's name is Dr. Wagner. And there's a couple others. He's actually been doing quite well with his book. He's been selling a lot of them each month. I mean, by a lot, I mean, he's not retired and getting rich yet, but he's actually doing pretty good with this, and he's working hard on it, and he's speaking at lectures and events, and it's good to see, you know, someone starting up a little project and have it work out for him. Now, onto our topic. On September 14th, 1486, Heinrich Cornelius Agrippa was born. Near Cologne, Germany, he was considered to be a very bright student. In 1500, he started a bachelor's at Cologne University. He began graduate studies at the age of 16, so he was a very rapidly advancing student. Agrippa had as one of his instructors Johannes Trithemius. Trithemius had an interest in astrology, cryptography, and magic. His works include Steganographia and De Septem Secundis. This was a world history based on astrology. Another one of Trithemius' students was a famous occultist and botanist known as Paracelsus. Paracelsus is by some accredited with contributions to psychotherapy, and one of his most well-known writings is Die große Wundertne, The Great Surgery Book, or The Great Miraculous Medicine, is sometimes known as. He was another student of Trithemius, as well as Agrippa. Both of them became fairly well-known occultists. Trithemius was, as I said, a very influential teacher to Agrippa. Cornelius Agrippa wanted to write a text that explained magic as a natural force from Trithemius' influence to sort of separate the idea of magic, natural magic, from, quote, what was we calling black arts, unquote, at the time. This can mean some different things to different people. Agrippa saw the magic of his day as being a bit sloppy and unrefined, and I think Trithemius sort of agreed with this conclusion and encouraged him to write something to bring about a more refined nature to it. Cornelius was as well, and so was Trithemius, his instructor, influenced by Dr. Albertus Magnus. Albertus Magnus, who is sainted in the Catholic religion, believed as well in a natural relationship between science and religion. So if you start tracing back the teacher instructor lineage here, you start to see how Agrippa is at least in some part influenced in how he views magic and, of course, views life, science, medicine. And again, Albertus Magnus, who influenced both Agrippa and his teacher, also believed in natural magic, or what might be more accurately described as a peaceful relationship between science and religion. Agrippa's teacher, again, did respect Albert the Great, again, Albertus Magnus, the saint. And after some time, onward to Agrippa's life, Agrippa did become a professor himself. In 1510, Agrippa began writing what some consider to be his most amazing work on magic. It was actually a series of three books, three being, of course, the magic number. Just as an atom in science has three parts, a proton, a neutron, an electron, the space between is known as the cloud. So, think of this. Three parts, and four elements. Kind of sounds familiar in the magical world. This series of three books is known as De Occulta Philosophia, what I mentioned earlier in the intro. The three books are categorized as follows. Book one, The Interactions and Hidden Relationships Between Substances. The Natural Effects of Things as They React, Without Effort, to Each Other. Simple, Natural Laws. It is believed that humans, men and women, may enjoy the shared natural virtues of nature through physical action, as well as natural philosophy. Book two of Agrippa's master working includes what he refers to as the virtues of the celestial realm. This is the realm of the sky. This is the wisdom of the stars, astrology, mathematics, numbers. This is applying the wisdom of the laws, the stars and numbers, to the natural virtues of Mother Earth. Elemental wisdom meets the wisdom of the skies, meets the wisdom of numbers. As above, so below. Book three in De Occulta Philosophia is the ceremonious practices necessary, Book of Ceremony, to bring about the union of these combined intelligences. Some say that the angels call upon one to be a practitioner of magic. A calling to magic is a deep religious calling, according to Cornelius Agrippa. So let's stop and review briefly what I just said and went over, because I jumped quickly. There are three different books in his masterworking. He had other works, by the way, and we'll get to that. But De Occulta Philosophia, book one, how the natural elements affect each other. Book two, the numbers and how to apply numbers to get things in proper rhythm, celestial rhythm, meaning the wisdom of the sky. Part of the number thing is, of course, astrology. So combining the wisdom of the sky, the wisdom of the natural way that things work on the earth. And I do see you there, it looks like, Brett. Book three is the ceremonies necessary to bring about the proper rhythmic relationship between earth and sky. The ceremonies necessary. A union of these combined intelligences. So I'm going to go ahead and take this call. It looks like our co-host Brett Hillman has joined us. Your microphone should be on now, Brett. Are you there?
I am here.
Okay.
It is me. So
I think you caught a little bit of what I was saying there. I saw your number pop up. Basically, I just did kind of an introduction, and I've started to go into, I haven't gone into much else about Agrippa, except for some of his influences. Albertus Magnus, of course, his teacher, Trithemius, and went into a little bit now of his first, or not his first, but his most well-known work, which was his three-book compilation.
Philosophia Magica.
Yeah. De Occulta Philosophia, yes. And so, you know, book one, as I just reviewed, book one, the way elements interact. Book two, numbers, astrology. Book three, ceremonies and the things needed to bring these things within rhythm of each other. So I'll go on a little bit further and talk about an aspect of this, and that is the idea of being called to the path of magic. Now, it's funny because Agrippa, and maybe you can comment on this, Brett, there seems to be a back and forth, at least in my research I did, between he wants to be an egalitarian about magic, but also does mention certain chosen people. Like, he wants to say it's just forces in nature that anybody can access, but at the same time, I sometimes get an, you know, impressions, especially when you start digging into the higher magic side of, okay, but only a few are chosen. Do you sort of have an opinion on that?
From what I seem to notice about it, his opinion was, when anyone can access these, but it's those that really try and work, some might get called to a higher amount. And that's when this newer magic comes into play, the higher magics come into play, and it's you have to first work with them before you're chosen, it seems.
Okay, so you think it might be more of an initiation, even if it's a self-initiation of you just putting in the work, perhaps?
Yeah,
so
that's
you
kind of what I've started to notice.
Yeah, because there does seem to be, because I have been reading from the actual text, which, of course, is laced with the slightly heavier language and takes a while. I didn't get a chance to go through the whole thing in between working in my 1 week of... Now, I've been familiar with Agrippa before this. It's why I was interested in him. And he has other aspects about him that also make him interesting. But there definitely seems like he wants to make magic seem accessible and natural, but then there is, like I said before, a talk about chosen and calling. And, yeah, I think you put it in an interesting way, Brett, that you get that calling after, or you get that being chosen after you sort of put in the work and engage in the elements and numbers.
Well, you have to show the interest of wanting to be chosen, and then, or at least wanting to do the work, and then you are chosen.
Yeah. Because I guess you could make the argument, you know, magic isn't for everybody. I know people that have absolutely no interest in it at all, and that's great. You know, it's not their thing. I've always been interested in metaphysics, and I just think it's interesting his sort of balance between being wanting to be the egalitarian and but still mentioning a bit of, you know, well, it's for the chosen. So there's kind of some back and forth with that, I think. But I think you put it in an interesting way. And as I saw it, there's one section where I do remember him saying that not only is it a higher calling, but as I had just mentioned, maybe it's not for everybody. It's not a calling that all will hear, or at least in this particular lifetime that all will hear. And most may not follow. Or if they do follow, will they do the work to be chosen, which is kind of a point you just made. Cornelius Agrippa started this work in 1510. That is the one that Brett and I are mentioning. He has other works as well. But he did not publish it until 1531. So this was something he was sitting on and working on for, you know, a good 21 years. Of course, what's 2 + 1, folks? 3. We're back to the 3 magic number again that we discussed earlier. And let's go in now to some things, and we'll come back to the Occulta Philosophia. Let's talk about some things that happened, of course, in between that time, that 21 years, when this writing was finally published. Agrippa had served 7 years in the army under Emperor Maximilian I. He had early on formed a secret society based on the study of Kabbalah and Hermeticism and the occult while schooling. He was pretty young. As I said, when he started graduate school, he was about 16. He was schooled as a doctor and as a legal expert. He became, for a while, a royal physician for the Queen Mother, Louise of Savoy, at the court of King Francis I. He was as well considered to be an unofficial court astrologer, as the Queen Mother had a passion for astrology herself. So she really liked having him around. He had once as well used his law background, because he was an expert in law at the time as well, to defend an old woman in the city of Metz, France, who was being unfairly accused in a witch hunt. And he was deemed as a heretic, and he moved away. He kind of traveled around a lot. He was, from time to time, threatened by the Inquisition, of course. And I think it's funny that the Inquisition started to really form powerfully around 1480. And in the 1480s is when Agrippa was born. So isn't it kind of funny how it reminds me of the movie The Dark Crystal, how when one of the good wizards dies, one of the evil ones died too. It's like something forms and then its resistance forms. And then when something goes, then, you know, the bad wizard went. So they both were birthed around similar times, this particular wizard and the Spanish Inquisition. He had been jailed by the Inquisition for a short time. He was banished a few times from places, but he was blessed to have friends in high places because he was respected for his talents as a musician. I mean, not musician, sorry, physician. And he was known as a bit of a miracle doctor, in fact. And he was sought after. He found, though it greatly helped him in many ways, being a royal doctor, he found those positions to be somewhat mundane. He was kind of an eccentric character, and they said that he didn't find these to be very, you know, the interesting, adventurous experiences that he was looking for with his research, even though his mysticism was supported, at least in the case of the Queen Mother, who was fascinated by astrology. But he found these things to be mundane and would often just walk away voluntarily from these jobs. He could have stayed at one of these places, at least for a while longer, and maybe lived a slightly safer existence. But he seemed to have enough friends in high places to keep him away from truly being taken by the Inquisition. Like I said, he was jailed for a relatively short period of time. So, Brett, now I'd like to go to another aspect of Agrippa, and that is something a little bit away from his mysticism, and we'll get back to that. And that is, one of Agrippa's writings was known as The Nobility and Superiority of the Female Sex. And this is actually, what's funny, is before my resurgence into occultism and paganism a few years back, as I came, you know, back and forth over the years, I actually first came across his name while researching something about feminism. And his name came up, and I was like, oh, he's an old mystic. That's kind of cool. And some feminist was quoting him, and I found it just kind of interesting. So, and that was years ago. And in this writing, he makes the argument about the realities of feminine divinity, as well as exploring how he sees the exclusion of women in public affairs, you know, political involvements, etc., as based on social conditioning, societal structures, and not bound to the abilities of a female because she's the opposite sex. So it sounds pretty obvious to a modern person, but back then that was very revolutionary. And the title, even just the title of this work, suggests female being superior in some ways. And again, that's very revolutionary for the 1500s.
Yes, indeed. Some call him one of the first feminists.
Yeah.
Because of that work. It's still in spiritual work, I'm sorry to say, women are always in much higher numbers than men. That they are, the spirituality of women is 9 times out of 10 stronger. I mean, there are notable exceptions, but when it comes to spiritual workings and stuff, women usually tend to take the higher place, if not hieratically, then just in actual work ethic. Of course, hierarchy, of course, is usually dominated by men, except for some pagan temples and ritual. Diana, Artemis, of course, being the stronger exceptions. But I think a matter of fact is that women are just more spiritual than men.
And Agrippa makes the argument, not only in spirit, but in some ways, physical connection to the body, such as in childbirth. The argument of the followers of Aristotle is like, men are so valuable because they plant the seed. You know, and of course, Agrippa makes the relatively obvious argument that, the female, of course, has a much more intimate physical relationship with the baby as she carries it for 9 months and feeds it, you know, breast milk, and is much more involved. There's even a part in his writing about what he called the superiority of women. There's a part in there even about how many children many young men will tend to look like their mother. I mean, that kind of can go back and forth. I'm just saying that was part of the writing. And of course, you can take this even one step further and back to the spiritual side of that, and back to the spiritual side of Agrippa claiming women to be spiritually superior is the example of Adam and Eve. And he does use a lot of biblical examples. I mean, this guy's a mystic and an occultist, but these people get their educations a lot of times from, you know, very Christian or Catholic universities or just little abbey schools. So they use a lot of biblical references. And he's, of course, Adam in Hebrew means dust or earth, and Eve means life, coming from the Hebrew Chaya.
Mother of all. Mother
yeah.
of all.
But actually, in its real simplistic form, but yeah, it could, it does go to mother of all, but in its really simplistic form, it's actually just breath or to breathe or just life, which is linked to breath, of course. So it's H-A-Y-A in Hebrew.
And another thing to note, with the biblical examples, it would also have a very heavily Kabbalah or, in some cases, some Gnostic writings as well.
Mm-hmm.
Would be a very big part where a lot of his spiritual heritage would come from.
Yes. And that's when you get into those combinations of Christianity and mysticism, such as Albertus Magnus, who Agrippa admired greatly. You know, he was a Catholic saint. And for those of you who have experiences with certain aspects of Catholicism, there's certain things Catholics do that downright look like magic and occult. You know, they have saints and, you know, they burn candles for a saint and say kind of this prayer, or almost, you know, I would say borderlining on a spell. I don't know if exactly would be casting a spell, but they're engaging an element or a couple different elements, water, holy water, air, incense, burning maybe a saint candle. They got fire, air, water represented, earth, because the holy water often has salt, and to attempt to gain a result in a matter. And these influences, of course, are not by accident. And so the educations that these mystics would receive would often, like we had just mentioned, they come from a Christian source originally. So that becomes a lot of their points of references to make their positions seem relatable to their fellow scholars. So, you know, again, back to the Adam and Eve point I just made, you know, Eve meaning mother, the original mother, or breath, or just life. And for those of you just joining us, our co-host Brett is here with us now, and it's Wednesday, our flagship show, Main Street Universe. Tomorrow will be Evan Pass, Ariana Radio. Friday, Kevin Baird, Walking on the Sidewalk. And Friday evening at midnight is Jesse Ann Nichols George, Activating Compassion in the Midnight Hour. And she is on tour right now, actually. So good for her. She's on her book tour. And her show is doing extremely well, by the way.
She has been busy. And yeah. we all have, as I know.
She is a hardworking gal, you know. I really like her a lot. And she works hard. She just goes after what she wants. And she does so in kind of a graceful way. You know, she doesn't seem like she's sweating, but you know she's working hard. Off the air, you know, on the phone and such, and she definitely has some interesting ways at looking at life and looking at things and turning it a negative into an affirmative and breaking things down and simplifying them. And I think a lot of people can benefit from her techniques. She has a lot of great mental and spiritual techniques for trying to simplify things and making what can seem like this big, crazy world overburdening you seem not so bad. That's Jesse and Nichols George. And today we're talking about, it's our first installment of our Great Mystics in History. We're discussing Cornelius Agrippa, who was alive in the 1500s, born around the same time when the Spanish Inquisition started. And he definitely had his run-ins with them, though not to the tragic ends that some people did. He had friends in high places that helped with that. He was not only a mystic, but a doctor, which was often the same thing back then. A lawyer, basically. He was a legal expert as well and was employed royally as a lawyer as well from time to time. And as a brief review for those joining us, his most well-known work was De Occulta Philosophia, of which was actually a series of three books, the first one mentioning natural magic, natural forces in nature, and how they interact with each other, sort of the effortless interaction of nature and how to tap into that, and how they're all related. The second one was celestial, as he says, and that is the wisdom of numbers, of the sky, astrology, mathematics, and proper rhythm, aligning to proper rhythm. And the third was the divine, and that's the ceremony necessary to get in tune with that proper rhythm, to be sort of on the same rhythmic page. And he went on through his life to be employed using both his physician skills as well as his legal ones. And he later began to talk a little bit about some people that he influenced, which will continue to this day, including feminist thinkers who would quote one of his famous workings. And even beyond the feminist thinkers, the other occultists, including John Dee, and he's mentioned in various works of fiction. He's mentioned in Harry Potter. He's mentioned in Mary Shelley's Frankenstein.
I'm pretty sure a few of our mystics will probably end up on that list that have been mentioned in Harry Potter. I'm sure we'll talk about men like Flamel in our mystic series.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Flamel is mentioned.
Was actually a very big point.
In his case, he was mentioned much heavier than Agrippa was in Harry Potter. Agrippa was sort of a flash. He was on a card, right, on like a magic card of some sort. He was mentioned in Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. He was referred to as the mortal immortal, and Victor Frankenstein in the book reads and admires him as one of, you know, part of his research to make, you know, Frankenstein, basically, as admiring him as an alchemist and a scientist. He's mentioned in another book called Fantasies. It's a fairy romance by George MacDonald. He's in a video game. There's a character called Agrippa, Dark Descent. And so let's go back again to the discussion about feminism. He was considered to be very revolutionary for not only mentioning that women, you know, have an equal part to play and have the same desires as men. I mean, even some conservatives of their day would say, well, okay, we understand that they deserve the same spiritual happiness and all of that. But they certainly were not ready to give a female divine status in the same way that they would for a male. And
the closest point to a, you know, spiritual woman put in a high place was Mary. And, I mean, she almost got raised to the third level of the Trinity, the fourth level of the Trinity, with how
right.
much power that she wields. But still, that is still a second rank. She is just a mediator.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a place of honor for the sake of honor, like men tend to get. The priests are always going to be male, and at least in Catholicism.
They're talking about it now. They're talking about nuns in the modern day and what their position is going to be, and there's like a battle over that now. So it's
but especially among specific orders. Yeah.
Yeah. And keep in mind, this is in the 1500s, so compare it to a conservative person, you know, now, and I'm using the word conservative kind of loosely here, folks. I don't necessarily always mean politically conservative, like, oh, it's a Republican. Let's clear that up. But I think you understand in the context what I mean. He actually writes in the 1500s on the nobility and superiority of the female sex. That's the name of the work. If somebody wrote that now, people would look at it like my father's generation. I'm not necessarily saying my father, I'm just saying my father's generation would look at it and go, oh, look at this liberal, blah, 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 this feminist. And this was in the 1500s, saying of the nobility and superiority of the female sex. Now, granted, he might have just been sort of an equalitarian. He might just actually think that men and women are equal, but felt the need to push it beyond that, like just knowing that he needed to, you know, sort of push the boundary a little further and say superiority. Because sometimes people do those things as an intellectual trick to sort of gain a little extra ground. So you kind of like if you're making a sale, you know, you bid a little higher than you really need to sell it at, you know. So he could have been doing that. Did he actually think females are superior than men? Or was he just being he was known to be a bit rebellious and eccentric.
And it could also be where are women superior as opposed to not. It's like not just saying that women are outright superior. There might be areas that they are,
right.
Which I do believe, you know, at least in the modern context.
Yes, because it is called on the nobility and superiority of the female sex. So he, like you said, that could be, okay, here's the topics on which, you know, that this is how I see them to be superior. Here's the area, like you said, that they seem to show a certain superiority. And so he became, as I said, I first heard his name from feminist readings and rantings and such. And this was during that in-between time in my life where I had sort of stepped away from paganism and such and, you know, forgotten some things. And his name, that's how I stumbled across him. And then later on, I stumbled across him in an occult book, and I was like, oh, yeah, I remember this guy. And then I stumbled across him in Oberon Zell's grimoire book as well. So it seemed like I had, you know how you start seeing somebody's name a lot, and you go, oh, okay, I guess I'm supposed to do a show about this, or whatever that thing in life you're supposed to do is. So we're discussing Agrippa as not only a mystic or an occultist, but also as someone espousing the virtues, and even in his title, the superiority of women in certain aspects of life, certainly in their connection to children. He even mentions in part of his writing how the women, especially back then, your nurses and the maids and the mothers are the ones that taught women to, or taught children to first speak. So the first speaking, you know, comes from the mother. And that was another aspect of the sort of physical superiority link to the child. He even mentions how a firstborn male can tend to even look like its mother. That can be maybe a debatable thing, but you know, something that he did. It is something he wrote. And we'll take it now to another place. We've discussed the feminist thing. We might come back to it. I'm going to now take this into another area where let's discuss the way he viewed magic, and let's discuss the way he viewed mysticism, the occult, because there's some debate, and I would like to get a little bit to that debate. And what I'm going to do is play a very brief song, get my thoughts together, refill my glass of water. So, Brett, when we come back, we'll be discussing the way he viewed magic, the way he viewed angels and demons.
Can't wait.
Elements. So, we'll be back in just a minute, Brett. I'm going to go ahead and play. This will be a Woven Green song. Traveler. Okay, I'm back, and for those of you that might just be tuning in, kind of a slow day here in the chat room. This often happens when we do a show that's kind of based on a topic rather than, say, being a divination episode or a reading. Sometimes shows like this get more archive listens, though, because I think maybe less people are interested in hearing readings after the fact. But the reading shows will pull in lots of live listeners. The phone lines will be usually stacked up. And the topical shows oftentimes, because it's Wednesday at 11 a.m., will have very low activity in the chat room. But we'll get might get three times as many archive listens. So, you know, you never know in this radio world what's going to happen. But there are some things, I guess, that are a little bit consistent. So, back to our topic, Cornelius Agrippa. And I'd like to discuss how Agrippa himself viewed magic. Are you there, Brett?
I'm here.
Okay. During the song, I turned your mic off briefly, and it should be back on, so I heard you.
I turned off my own mic, so.
Okay. There is some people that have a debate as to how Agrippa viewed magic. I don't know if you ran into any of this in your research. And I can actually see both sides. There's one side that says that Agrippa was not particularly fond of specifically naming specific, like, angels or demons. He viewed, like, in his first book, things as being just working with natural elements and the forces in the universe combined with the mathematical intelligence of the sky, and then the divinity being how you saw the great creator. But then there are some aspects of what he writes that do talk about angels and demons. I think especially later on, something that, not much later on, because he didn't live much past the publishing of the Occult of Philosophia. So it might have been in that in-between time. And he did discuss these things. Now, some people discuss the authenticity of some of those writings where he mentions more. So what I'm trying to get to is, some people say he conjured up demons, and that he did this sort of thing that became later on influenced the people that would then, you know, engage in forms of demonology, Goetia, all that kind of stuff, shouting at it, these dark forces. So he did write about angels and demons, and I think he even wrote on different levels of them and what they're for and what they do. And that, you know, of course, the angels were more powerful than these demons are. So you could summon both. This is something Aleister Crowley attempted to do in a long ritual that was supposed to take 6 months that he did not finish at first. He finished it later. But so some people said that maybe he experimented with it for a short time, but then went back to his just sort of natural magic way of looking at it. I don't know if what you had run across in your research, well, considering how he viewed magic. Right.
Well, yes, and you and I also talked about it a little bit, you know, in preparation for the show. The difference between, say, high magic and low magic, we discussed rather heavily. And the high magic is, you know, the invoking, the massive ceremony involved. And the low magic's kind of the more looking at the forces of what we're working with. And, you know, most people kind of fall in between. I mean, there are some people that do the high magic, like the Golden Dawn, and the Lima is high magic with a big hammer, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
And we're looking at low magic as kind of, we can say, kitchen witchery for our pagan, you know, audience that kind of know, but the voodoo, root work, hoodoo, those things all kind of fall more under a combination of the two.
Right.
It's where there are spirits that name, but you work with the natural forces. And I think he kind of drifted into the more middle path, but his base was always looking at the natural forces as opposed to beings.
Yeah, I think he, like anything, I mean, let's consider, you know, you're trying to piece this knowledge together, just like people in the modern world trying to piece it together. So he may have experimented with this, that, and the other, you know, to come to his conclusions. I remember one writing I stumbled across in my research was, and he named, you know, 9 levels of angels and what they do, and then a certain, like, 9 or whatever the number level was of demons and what they do. And, of course, some people invoke these beings by name, like we said. There's a big debate, too, I'd like to breathe across in case the listeners or future listeners hear the terms high and low magic. They're words that I do sometimes stray from because some people get funny opinions about it, like, is it better or superior, or is it just simply different or a different way of seeing things? And the terms high and low, I think sometimes saying high magic comes from the idea that it's very ceremonial and official. That's one way to look at it. I mean, some say because it is the summoning and evoking. And then some people might make the argument, what's the difference anyway? If you're using the forces of nature, aren't you getting the same result as if you summon something to get use the forces of nature? There becomes the debate. Some people think, and I'll clarify what I'm saying, that you have to evoke one of these other beings from the other side to make this work. Some people don't. Some people think evoking the elements, being thankful and such and reverent to whatever pantheon you're engaged with is plenty enough to use to be a successful practitioner of magical and metaphysical forces. And so here's the argument that sometimes happen. People that are a little more, I'm using this word very loosely, low magic, will sometimes just say, aren't they just trying to put a name on one of these spiritual beings because it's just human tendency to want to put a face and a name on something? You know what
well,
I mean?
Of course, yeah. So I think we really should do a show not necessarily on high and low magic, but evocation and invocation.
Yeah.
Because one is calling beings and one is the magic of the self, and I think it's a combination of the two, not a either or. We kind of need both for it to work. Because if you don't use your own, I mean, if you don't give anything of yourself, what's going on? It's like, it's one of those, you know, you hear this prayer over and over of winning the lottery, but if you don't buy the ticket, it'll never work.
Yeah.
You know.
If you forget the rules, and of course, one of the first ones being as above, so below, as with without, so within, which would be actually, you know, buying the ticket would be the without. And I also want to be very, for those of you, if you happen to tune in, and some may, that happen to be of ceremonial or high magic leaning or just interest, I would also like to say that this doesn't mean that I think that these forces that they invoke are not real. I don't necessarily do this thing where I call upon the name of some, you know, demon somewhere. It doesn't mean I think that the force isn't real. So I'm also very respectful of that as well. I just want to get that out there. I'm very respectful that they're calling upon very real forces in the universe. The debate usually just happens to, is it necessary to call something with a specific name? Or here's an example, Brett, and I'll clarify this, of how it's a combination, like you said. Like, for example, I work with a matron goddess deity. So that's about as close as I would get to invoking a specific being. And that would be, in my particular case, is Kuan Yin. So, yeah, I will call her name just like I would call the god Serenos. And so I sort of have an eclectic pantheon. And those are the names that make sense to me. So in that way, you could say I'm borderlining onto the high magic stuff. I mean, would you kind of agree with that?
I wouldn't. I would have to say also that while I work with gods, I do go down and work with the more primal forces. And heck, I even work with forces that are way outside my pantheon, which is a more European flavor, Celt, Goth, Nordic.
Right.
But then I also work with Michael the Archangel.
Okay.
Which is completely on the other side of the spectrum, you know.
But that makes, because I don't necessarily think you and I would be considered pagans that are high magic, ceremonial, golden dawn.
Oh, no.
But that makes us close to that in a way, because we are calling a name.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not like a name of like a list of 74 demons or whatever it is in the Galatia. Or other texts, you know, the original Lesser Keys of Solomon and all of this.
But we do work, you know, we do know of these works, and we actually do, a couple of our practices are adapted of this work. If we follow the more pagan, modern pagan teaching, a lot of our tools are from the Lesser Keys of Solomon.
Right.
We touch them, it's not like we avoid them like the plague. It's just it's not our working. It's not our purview. We are much more, I would say we are much more eclectic, and we would call ourselves more, I would call myself a low magician. But I would also just call it as a more, a baseline working with the spiritual forces of the universe. We tap into these things. We call Main Street, you know, we're working that everything is closer than we thought. It's not all the way up here. It's right in our own backyard. It's in our own thoughts. It's in our houses.
And that's where this can get dizzying of you have somebody like Agrippa, who's a very influential occultist, and excuse me, and he talks about simple natural magic as well as what some would call high magic, and even listing some purposes of angels and various demons. And for those of you who I'd like to, in case others are listening and go, gosh, these guys are talking about demons, if you look into the word demon, it often means something similar to a guide. A lot of people use the argument that a being that's now being called a demon was one that at one point was just a god of a conquered tradition.
Well, so, doesn't it come from the similar root word that we get deva from?
Yeah, god and deva, and there's when you start doing the etymology or just history, such as you'll see, like, there's demons that have, like, elephant heads and things like that, if you ever look at any of these books. And one could say they were just trying to, you know, make, say, you know, Ganesh look bad or whatever, you know, in the Hindu pantheon. So there's a lot of different directions you can go when you start bringing up this word, both historical or in just basic, you know, etymological history. And like we're talking about, when one people conquers another, they make the old pantheons, you know, quite literally, you know, demonize them, make them look, well, they're the bad guys, you can't worship them anymore. Now, this is also, I'd like to clarify, I do not consider myself to be a demonologist by any stretch. I take more of the approach that it's natural forces, kind of the way, you know, Aristotle and Pythagoras look at it. But at the same time, I'm reverent of the other forces out there and understand and am respectful that there are things that I don't exactly understand. So we are right now at about 20 minutes left, and we've been discussing the history of in the works and some of the reputation of Cornelius Agrippa. And discussing how he looks at magic and the things he influenced. Like, he definitely influenced John Dee. Some people say that Agrippa had a familiar that was a black dog that shows up later in various stories about Faustus. We'll get to that another day. There's a mystic that they claim made a deal with the devil. So they say upon his death, he released this dog, and they say this dog shows up, you know, later in history. And he's appeared in some fiction as well, Frankenstein and Harry Potter, a few books, video games. And another thing I thought was interesting is that in his early life, his teacher Trithemius, had another student who became a fairly well-known occultist, and I mentioned this earlier in the show, I think right before you got here, who was Paracelsus.
Yes.
And Paracelsus was actually known for some contributions to psychotherapy. And go ahead.
Not one that I know of, but I'm not surprised in the very least because of his work. He does deal a lot with the mind.
The alchemist of old. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, well, he deals a lot with the mind and thought in his works.
Oh yeah.
So it makes no major leap of logic to think that he did contribute at least to some of the theories of men such as Jung and who would have also influenced men like it's going to drive me nuts now. Pure with the Thousand Faces, the archetypes that we have now as well.
And Paracelsus was, as well as his contribution to mentioning the unconscious mind, and it was some of the ways that psychotherapists interpret some of his working. Also had another work that was Die große Wundertechnik, which was known as the Great Surgery Book or the Great Miraculous Medicine. And Paracelsus also wrote, as part of that, he was big into living in tune with nature and all of these things. And so two, you know, very influential occultists being taught by the same teacher at that time period during the Inquisition, I thought was kind of interesting. And, of course, all within, you know, the abbeys and the Catholic universities and in that world back then. And a lot of these people would take on names that, an example being Trithemius, that is a name that is related to the region from which he grew up. And I forgot his original name, forgive me, but that was common in that era for people to take on a Greek or Latin-sounding name, sort of Latinize their name or make it sound like, you know, a Greek. Now, in Agrippa's case, I think he was actually born Agrippa, even though he's born in Germany, which Agrippa is usually thought of as a Greek name. But many of these scholars would change their name to something that kind of sounded Latin. In Paracelsus.
But it was the language of the Ecclesiasta. I mean, it survived as a language of the smart, the priest, the learned.
Yeah, so, it was considered you were high society. You were considered to be educated. You know, you weren't a commoner. You were a man of culture, and you were a man of. Of, like you said, education, and sorry, my computer was acting a little funny. Out here, sometimes the signal, I saw the page blank out for a second, and I was like, oh, don't tell me I just lost the show, but I didn't.
You did not. You're still here, so.
It's usually
still here.
Strong out here, and sometimes it'll just, something will happen, and it'll go really slow. So, yeah, the page blanked out, but that's okay. I'm getting it back. I'm still on the air. So we discussed many aspects. His most famous work, Agrippa, was the Occulta di Philosophia, and broken up, of course, into three parts. And we discussed a little bit early before you got here, Brett, the importance of the number three, and of course Agrippa was all about the numbers as well. And of course there's three elements in an atom, you know, the proton, the electron, neutron. And here's the example I used, was the atom is made up of three parts, and the space between the parts is called the cloud. And so it's three parts, but you could say four elements. So I think that's another thing that kind of seems funny, that it has in common with natural occult philosophy and physics. Well, it's something having three parts or four parts, and that fourth one considered maybe an element. And I think I almost got page back.
Yes. We still take a lot of threes. Fours, sevens are big. But three, the Druids, for example, really heavily rely on three. Earth, sea, sky, sun, star.
Oh, yeah.
The inner, lower, middle. Three is a very common way to view the universe, is in threes.
And I think one of the interesting things about using the numbers and astrology and the elements that he speaks on, back to the natural magic side, is there is still, even though it's natural and it's, and these things will just happen anyway, as he says, engaging in the numbers is how you get into a proper rhythm. And that's what book two was so important in his the occult philosophy, is it's like, okay, here's the natural forces, and I'll explain why they all interact and why they all affect each other effortlessly. But engaging in the numbers and in the wisdom of the sky, your part, engaging your intelligence basically into this, this is where you do your work, is in book two, I think, a lot of it. Then there is the, once you've learned the language of symbols and numbers, then book three is the ceremony necessary to combine all of these things together and to make them all work for you in a magical sense. I still don't have my page back, but it's okay. I got my backup computer inside, and I'll go to that one.
I'm kind of in the same boat as you. Our internet is completely down here at Schoolcraft today, so it's like, of course, I won't have my notes. So.
Wondering why I sound sometimes a little slow. I actually feel really good today. I've been living better, and I've been breathing great the last week and a half or so, 2 weeks, and sinus infections gone, allergies gone, so I'm extremely grateful. We had a really good episode last Sunday with Thea Sabin and Reverend Don. That was a very nice episode. My brother Scott, Reverend Scott Seymour Michael, joined us.
I made sure, I actually called in his show this week, and I made sure to thank him again for being on the show with you all.
Yeah, it was fun. And it was one of those, when you have a 4- and 5-way conversation, they can be hard to regulate. But it went relatively interruption-free. I listened to the archives, and I was really happy to see that the interruptions were fairly minimal. Because it was me, Janice, Reverend Don, Thea, and my brother, and another person came in at one point. So it was a pretty large crowd there. And to have minimal interruption shows me that, we're getting a little better at this.
That seems to be one of our bigger shows, then, except for the one where you and I were doing readings with Kevin and Janice.
Those shows win a lot of live listeners. I have discovered that's why sometimes I do them. Sometimes I just want to do a topical show. And oftentimes the topical shows, like the one with the bees, the one with the bats, they do really well in the archives.
Yes.
The bee one is doing extremely well in the archives. Still, we still get new numbers for that one all the time.
Should be checking tonight on our iTunes and see how we're doing there, because it's been a while. I let it sit for a few months without checking it, and I believe we actually do have a comment there, which I haven't brought up yet. But
okay.
I'm going to be checking that probably tonight, because I'm the one that posted it, so I have some the ability to look it over, and I think we're actually getting some decent listeners through iTunes.
I think so, too, because there was one show I did, and I'm not going to say the name of it because I felt bad. I didn't really promote much.
Mm-hmm.
It was just a little episode, but it got way more ratings than I was expecting. And I really didn't do anything to promote it. I'm like, okay, I must be getting some of these ratings from somewhere else. I mean, I get my normal ones that I kind of expect to get from doing my natural promotions that I'm used to doing. But these were ratings that were, I didn't do anything to gain them. So I was thinking, I bet you that's coming from iTunes. That was the only thing I could think of.
Well, I made it a point to say I was not going to check iTunes for 2 months just to see how it went without any touching or control, and then I was going to take a more active role. I don't think I actually do anything anyway, but I can say we're on iTunes and stuff like that, do better on Facebook through our Facebook group and stuff like that, and we'll see if there's a change after that as well. But
yeah.
We are in a section. They put us in a place, and we are up on iTunes. I believe
yeah.
it's under the name Daniel Michael,
okay.
which is exactly what our radio station is.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, that's good.
I think
that's where they might be coming from, some of them, because I checked in the archive, like I said, of one that I was just so busy I didn't get a chance to promote it, and it actually did okay. You know, it was, and then when I went ahead and promoted it, it did a little better, but I was surprised at the amount it got without me touching anything, you know, without me sending it out or
posting. Well, some RSS feeds for archives does help, because we will always have that.
Yeah.
Would you ask, our Mystic series is probably going to be once a month, correct?
Once a month, maybe once every 2 months, depending on how things are going. And we'll continue. For those listening, I came back inside. My computer outside. It didn't crash. It just, I was off the studio page all of a sudden. I was still online, though. I don't know what happened. So I'm inside, and studio page is fine. We were talking about Cornelius Agrippa, who his most famous work was De Occulta Philosophia. It didn't exactly go in depth into his work. We were kind of briefly covering his life, you know, you can in a show.
We had a month of shows, we could do better, but...
Yeah, well, we may revisit some of these things in the future. And what I mean is, I didn't just research his life. I mean, I am actually in the process of reading his works. And some of it is the original one, which has a lot of thick language in it. And it takes a while to read, especially on a computer screen, which is not my favorite. I think I got to print it out. But I have been reading it. I love sacredtext.com. Get some great information there. So we might do, when we upon a return, even if it's just a partial episode return, more about the integral working of his actual system of magic. This one was more about a brief overview of his life and his multiple works.
Maybe
as I said before, we're not always an instruction show about, you know, how to be a great, you know, wizard. We're more of a kind of a topic show that occasionally talks about paganism and the occult and stuff like that. But we can occasionally
do an episode
like
on
that.
Magical systems and like magical systems in general, and we can touch on a couple of these different topics and maybe
yeah.
revisit some of the mystics that we talk about, make it like kind of after the mystics, and then we
right.
can kind of come back and touch their
compare and contrast
views and how they relate, yeah.
such as Agrippa's influence influenced some of these other people that started doing things we talked about later, like the calling the specific names of spirits, the specific names of angels, and even demons. Some say his more interesting aspect of his work was the aspect of just working with the natural forces and with numerology and with just nature elements, as well as with metals and different materials. He was an alchemist. So he's respected in the alchemy circles, and as well was a writer who is quoted by feminist authors. You know, Nobility and Superiority of Women was the title of his work in the 1500s. That's pretty controversial for back then, folks. It might even be controversial
today.
Now.
Well, I'm sadly going to have to call this episode.
Yes, we're on.
I'll leave you to close off. So I will catch you next week.
Okay, thank you very much, Brett. That was Brett Hillman joining us. And I'm turning your mic off now. We still have a few minutes left. We were discussing great mystic and occult philosopher, thinker, theologian, alchemist, physician, and lawyer, Cornelius Agrippa, in the 1500s, born around the same time the Spanish Inquisition was getting its a strong foothold there in certain parts of Europe. He wrote his most famous working, De Occulta Philosophia. He as well wrote Nobility and Superiority of Females. He as well was at times employed as a royal physician. He had been at one point incarcerated by the Inquisition, but since he had friends in high places and was known as kind of a miracle doctor, he was released in a short period of time, so he didn't die at the hands of the Inquisition. His most famous working involved three basic parts, three basic books. One discussed natural elemental magic, just the relationship of substances with each other and elements with each other. The second one was numerology, the wisdom that he called celestial, wisdom of the sky, astrology, and numbers. The third was ceremonial magic. The ceremonial magic involved the techniques necessary, the rituals, the ceremonies necessary to bring into harmony, to bring into rhythm the first two. So his name was Cornelius Agrippa, doctor, lawyer, some say feminist, mystic, theologian, philosopher, alchemist, wizard. Thank you, everybody, for joining us here today. This was the first in our series that we'll do once a month or once every 2 months called The Great Mystics of Our Past. Thank you very much. You've been listening to Main Street Universe, the show reminding you that the mysteries and possibilities of the universe are closer to Main Street than you may have ever imagined. And I don't know about you, I can imagine a lot. Thank you.